You're just in time for the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. Here, you'll find answers to your questions about the Christian faith, the Bible, and trends in the church today. At the Christian Research Institute, we do what we do because truth matters. As you hear today's program and you're interested in the topics discussed and you'd like to find out more, contact the Christian Research Institute at 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website at www.equip.org. And now, here's the host of the Bible Answer Man, Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy. We'll go to your calls in just a few moments. Do want to mention the Last Disciples series, the last in the trilogy now available, The Last Temple. You can get all three books together for your gift to the ongoing work of the Christian Research Institute. And when you give a gift of $100 or more, I'll send you a copy of The Last Temple along with the other two that is personalized to you, a family member or a friend. That's also true when you join the monthly Bible Answer Man support team, and you can check that out on the World Wide Web at equip.org. Of course, the questions that I address in this trilogy using the power of story are very timely today. Has God indeed given Jerusalem exclusively to the Jews in the present? Is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from Jerusalem a biblical axiom and a two-state solution a blasphemous abomination? Does the presence of God reside in Jerusalem in a special and powerful way? More to the point, is Jerusalem still to be regarded as the holy city? And if so, why do both Old and New Testaments label Jerusalem the harlot city? And what of the heavenly city, Jerusalem? Why does the Apostle Paul say the Jerusalem that is above is free and she is our mother? Well, of course, the reason is that the holy city was a place where God's glorious presence dwelt among the people. And the city of Jerusalem is a type, therefore, that pointed forward to the coming of Jesus who dwelt among us in human flesh. And so today, it is not the Jerusalem below, but the Jerusalem that is above that catches our fancy. And it is not a temple of luminous limestone and glistening gold that we look forward to. No, it is Christ who has come. He is the fulfillment of temple and priest and sacrifice. He is the ultimate sacrificial lamb. And so that is the reason we call this the last temple, because the temple that Jesus said would be destroyed was destroyed precisely as he said it would be destroyed. And now the living temple is in our midst. So we don't look forward to a tribulation temple or to a millennial temple. We are living stones in the temple of God. A lot of you hanging on. We'll go right to the phone calls. First up today is Jerry in Homesdale, Pennsylvania, listening on the web. Hi, Jerry.
Hey there, Hank. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Great. Thank you, first of all, for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I got into a debate friendly discussion is what it started out as, with my boss, actually, regarding the Sabbath. He's a Seventh-day Adventist, and basically, where it started off was, what do you believe as a Christian? Do you believe in the Ten Commandments? Do you follow the Ten Commandments? And I said, of course I do. Which then led to, well, what about the seventh-day Sabbath? How come you throw that one out the window? And I gave the answers that I had always been given as a kid, and I thought I knew and was pretty solid in, which was that the law was of no effect in terms of, the ritual aspects of the law. And he said, well, that's not a ritual aspect of the law. And I studied it and found out he was right. So basically, what that led me to was doing a lot of reading, a lot of personal study, a lot of talking to various pastors that I've gotten to know over the years, and all the answers that I got really didn't cover it. I had answers thrown back that the law was thrown out, that the day was changed due to Christ's resurrection. Just a variety, pardon me, of answers that really didn't cover it. So what I came to through my study, and correct me if I'm wrong, and that's why I'm calling you, is that the Sabbath, in the Old Testament Sabbath, is a day of rest from sin. Being that, and a reminder of things to come, and a reminder of the freedom from the Egyptians to the Israelites. But with Christ's death and resurrection, Christ has now become our rest. He is the promise is fulfilled.
Yep.
So the no jot or tittle shall be removed from the. From these words of the law that Christ was talking about, it has that part has been fulfilled, and the rest of the law is still it's a perfect guidebook, but that Sabbath aspect has been fulfilled. Now that's where I stop talking and ask you what you think.
No, I agree. The New Testament emphasis is on grace, but the law remains the guide for living out the Christian life, and to suggest that all of the law has been thrown out or abrogated simply isn't true.
Right.
And that is to miss the import of what law means. Words are not univocal, they're equivocal. So the Bible uses law in different ways. The law maintains order in society. The law reveals sin. The law is a guide for the believer in living out the Christian life, as I just said. And then there are civil aspects of the law. There's ceremonial aspects of the law. There are moral aspects of the law. So to blanketly say that the law is of no effect today is not to be careful in your use of words and your delineation of what you really mean when you talk about the law. But I agree with you. I mean, I think the issue here that is of import is that Jesus Christ fulfills certain aspects of the law. In fact, he did not come to abolish the law or the prophets. He came to fulfill them, and he did that in every single way. Not the smallest jot, not the least stroke of a pen will disappear from the law until everything is fulfilled, said Jesus Christ.
Right.
So what we do in worshiping on Sunday is, in effect, recognize that Jesus Christ is the one in whom we have our Sabbath rest. And that's the point for the emerging Christian church. They didn't want to fall into the dangerous snare of failing to recognize that Jesus was the substance that fulfilled the symbol of the Sabbath. And they also didn't want to go back to laws that were part of a theocratic kingdom. Because if you hold to Sabbatarian laws, then you'd have to stone someone to death if they violated the law. If they lit a fire on Sunday, for example, which would be tantamount to turning your ignition switch on in your car. So I think it's really important that we should not judge anybody on this matter. That's what Paul says. Do not let anyone judge you by what
right,
you
so
eat.
The day doesn't matter, correct?
Beg pardon?
Technically, the day doesn't really matter. We could worship on Thursday.
Yes, exactly. But the reason that the day matters is this. I agree with your point in substance, but there's a reason that a day matters, and that is that we were never born in isolation from one another. So it's not as though you, Jerry, are a Lone Ranger Christian and I, Hank, am another Lone Ranger Christian. No, rather, when we are baptized, we are saying that we are joining a community of faith. When we take communion, we're taking communion in community. And therefore, I would say that there is an import on the day. But the real issue is not the day. The real issue is a recognition, just as you said in the prologue to your question, that Jesus is the one in whom we have our Sabbath rest. And again, to go to the text that Paul uses, or the words of Paul in the text of Colossians, where he says, do not let anyone judge you by what you eat or drink, or with regard to a religious festival, a new moon celebration, or a Sabbath day. These are a shadow of the things that were to come. The reality, however, is found in Christ. What he does in descending order, as he goes from annual to monthly to weekly demonstrations, so that we can see ultimately Jesus as the satisfaction. And therefore, we need to focus on Jesus as the fulfillment.
Exactly. And now, one thing, I know I've taken a whole bunch of time here, but just real quick. The Seventh-day Adventist Church, basically, what I ended up finding out through the course of this conversation was the hook that pulls you in is you don't really understand the law as a fundamentalist Christian. And the relation of Sabbath. I mean, basically, that's what it came down to. That's what pulled me into this debate. What happens then, though, is once they get you to think that you are misunderstanding the Sabbath, the conversation then turns to the authority of the Sabbath being an indoctrination, being something that was set up by Constantine, by the Catholic Church, and that by worshiping on the Sabbath, whether you're Baptist, Methodist, Lutheran, whatever, you have put yourself under the authority of the Catholic Church. And they turn it into an end times thing, that now you have taken the mark of the beast. I don't know whether you've ever heard that, because I had never heard it previously.
Have I heard it? I mean, it seems that every time I go out and speak, I will autograph books, and then I'll be talking to people, and oftentimes it's late into the night, and there's always a little cluster of people that wait to the very end, and invariably they're Seventh-day Adventists, and they come up and they start this discussion, and it's sort of Columbo fashion. And if I end up not agreeing with them or continuing to point out what I've just pointed out, then they say, well, I've taken on the mark of the beast.
Well, and that's the scary thing. I just found it really kind of dangerous, because you never hear, or I really have never heard the Seventh-day Adventist Church called out as a cultic religion.
You have to be careful there, too. And the reason that I think that you have to be nuanced there is I have met all kinds of Adventists. Now, the traditionalists won't accept what I'm saying right now, but I have met Adventists who are not traditionalists, and therefore they don't major on aberrant Adventist doctrines like soul sleep or Sabbatarianism or even the seer status of Ellen G. White. Rather, they embrace essential Christian doctrine, so they're thoroughly orthodox in that sense. And then there are Adventists who are thoroughly liberal, by the way, who not only compromise and confuse, but consistently contradict essential Christian doctrines like the virgin birth, the bodily resurrection, and so forth. So there are different kinds of Adventists, but the traditionalists are the ones that are, bent on saying that I've taken on the mark of the beast because I worship on Sunday.
Right. Yeah, well, it's just something I wanted to mention, that people need to be aware, because it's easy to get sucked into. I've been a Christian since I was 9 years old, and I'm 43 now, and thought I knew better, and I got snagged. And that's where the debate started, and it was really a stumbling block for a while. So thank you again for clarifying that and reinforcing some points that I came to through study. And I'm telling you, I wish I could talk to you for a couple hours.
Well, I could talk to you for a couple hours, too. I mean, you are very insightful, and appreciate this conversation. I know it's helped a lot of people.
Thanks a lot, Hank.
You got it. Back to the phone lines. We'll talk to Josh next, Bakersfield, California, listing on the web. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show. I apologize. I'm a little distracted. I'm watching my one-year-old daughter as I'm trying to ask my question here. But, first off, before I ask the question, I just wanted to say I really appreciate your ministry. I appreciate how you value truth, and especially, like, within the church, there seems to be often, like, kind of embarrassing, like, passing around of almost like Christian urban legends and things that people use to support their argument that are really, not very factual. And I appreciate that you don't do that, you don't deal in that, but that you really protect, the credibility of the church by always, dealing in truth and hard facts. And so, yeah, I just really appreciate that. My question is about Ezekiel Well, starting with the context of Ezekiel chapter 18, I believe it is, I've heard you on your show mention this passage in establishing that God doesn't hold children accountable for the sins of their fathers and vice versa. And I totally agree with that. That's kind of what it seems like he's getting across in that chapter. But I wonder, how do we understand passages like one that really came to mind is it's in 2 Samuel chapter 12, I believe. And Nathan is confronting King David, and he's telling him, you know, that what he did is wrong as far as murdering Uriah and committing adultery with Bathsheba. And God, through Nathan, you know, tells David that as a result, you know, the punishment, because I think it says in, I think it's like verse 12, or no, I take it back, I think it's verse 14, he says that because of this sin, you know, he scorns the Lord, that God was going to take his child, that he was going to kill the child. And it says later in the next, I think the next verse or the verse after, that God strikes the child with an illness, and eventually, you know, the child dies.
Now the question is, how can God do that? We're going to have to leave this as a cliffhanger. Can you stick with me? I'll pick it up on the other side of the break, and we'll answer that question, a very important question. We'll be right back.
The origin of the universe and human life is the apologetic issue of our day, and every Christian needs to be equipped to speak out clearly when atheistic evolutionists confront us with their alleged scientific proofs. Hank's newest book, The Creation Answer Book, puts dozens of answers to the most hotly debated questions right at your fingertips. And it's our thank you to you today when you partner with us in ministry through your gift of any amount. Your gift truly matters. So go online now to equip.org or call 888-7000-CRI. Stay with us. Hank Hanegraaff will be right back with more after this. The first century AD, a time of tribulation and terror as the Roman Empire descended on Jerusalem and the prophecies of Jesus and the book of Revelation came shockingly true before believers' very eyes. Now, this period of persecution, prophecy, and perseverance comes to life for you in a new work of fiction, The Last Temple, the long-anticipated completion of The Last Disciple trilogy by Hank Hanegraaff and Sigmund Brauer. You'll understand why Revelation's apocalyptic language was perfectly appropriate for these horrifying days and gain new courage to live out your faith in our own troubled times. The Last Temple is our thank you for your gift today. For your gift of $100 or more, we'll send you the whole Last Disciple trilogy. So please partner with us today by calling 888-7000-CRI or visiting equip.org. For decades, Mormon leadership has made a concerted effort to win over Americans by making it appear Mormons hold the same basic tenets as Christians. That's why Hank has taken the actual teachings of Mormons themselves and distilled them into an important resource to help you grasp the essential doctrinal differences between Mormonism and Christianity, The Memorable Keys to the Mormon Mirage Flipchart. Through the memorable acronym MORMON, you'll learn how Mormon leaders have redefined Christian terms so they can sound like they're agreeing with us, but mean something entirely different. But more importantly, you'll be equipped to use the deviations to share the truth in love with Mormons as God provides opportunities. Order Memorable Keys to the Mormon Mirage from the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Are you the product of millions of years of unguided, purposeless processes, or created in the image of a loving God? Faced with the overwhelming scorn of evolutionary proselytizers, it can be hard to articulate the truth about God's creative work, and even among faithful Christians, many misconceptions linger. That's why we want to send you a copy of Hank's Creation Answer Book in appreciation for your gift of ministry support today. The Creation Answer Book puts answers to the most hotly debated origins questions right at your fingertips, giving you clarity and understanding. Your gift is important, supporting more of the broadcast and resources that have changed your life. So please give today by calling 888-7000-CRI or visiting equip.org. That's equip.org. And let us rush you your copy of the Creation Answer Book. Thank you for your partnership. The end of the world, or God's great confirmation of Jesus as Messiah? The prophecies in Revelation have long been a hot topic of debate. Now, Hank brings them to life for you in his fiction work, The Last Temple, the long-awaited third novel in the Last Disciple trilogy. In appreciation for your gift of ministry support today, we'll send you The Last Temple, or for a gift of $100 or more, we'll send you the whole trilogy. Your support makes the Bible Answer Man broadcast possible, so please call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Now here's Hank Hanegraaff with more of the answers you need today.
Thank you very much, Randy. We'll go right back to our phone callers. We have Josh hanging on. He's asking a question about why is it that David's son ends up dying? Why does his child die as the consequence of David's sin? And I think, Josh, therein lies the answer. There are consequences to sin that follow inexorably, like night follows day. And as a result of that, we see David, who not only has an adulterous relationship with Bathsheba, but also has Uriah killed, as you noted, on the battlefront. And because of that, there are severe consequences. And unfortunately, there are casualties in the process. For example, if a father today is an alcoholic, it has a consequence to one extent or another on a child. I was reading this morning about Andy Reid. His son was found dead. And the newspaper article was talking about how brutal a sport football is, in that it totally sucks the time of a football coach, such that the football coach has very little time for a family and is always gone and is completely absorbed in the game and so forth. And then actually was making the point that perhaps that was one of the reasons that his boys had been in prison, had been dealing drugs and various things. Now, I can't comment on the merits of all of that, but the principle is there. I mean, there are consequences to the sins that pass on from the fathers to the children. But the children are not judged for the sins of the fathers. In fact, in eternity, God takes every converging factor into consideration, and therefore his judgments are altogether just and righteous and pure and holy.
And I totally agree with that, and I'm not trying to call God's goodness into question, but it just seemed to me to be a little different situation than for example you were mentioning that there's consequences to actions. And for example, if father was an alcoholic and he was driving under the influence and he crashed the family vehicle, and his children were in the car and they died, I would see that more as a cause and effect, consequences in a universe that has rules and gravity and all these things. But it seems like in this situation, like this is specifically God saying, that this isn't really like the child got ill, or this is God, labeling this his punishment on David is that he's going to kill his child, or that, that he's going to actually do this. And that's where, to me, again, not trying to call into question the goodness of God, but it felt like it was a little harder to rationalize or to figure out in the context of Ezekiel chapter 12.
But, yeah, well, I love the way you've set all this up. I mean, first of all, you've taken that which is clear, the Ezekiel passage, and you've made that the premise. Now you're dealing with something that we don't have all the details on. There are hints in the passage. There's the hint that God does not want the enemies of David to have reason to blaspheme the name of God, which is the ultimate issue here. And perhaps in some sense, the child died as a consequence in that fashion. But again, we can't, as human beings, take every converging factor into consideration. We don't know all of the circumstance, and therefore we're speculating to some degree. But the principle is inviolate, and that is consequences follow to the third and fourth generation, but each person is judged for their sin. Now, again, there are different theological structures that look at this in different ways. So some say, well, God looks down the corridor of time and sees what that child would have done, and he's judged on that basis. There are different theological camps, but ultimately, what I'd like to do is leave that child in the hands of an infinitely just and infinitely merciful God, and recognize that the worst thing that can happen for a child is not to die young. The worst thing that can happen is to live a long, robust life and never use it in service of the master, or turn, as Absalom did, against his father. So there are a lot of things that we don't understand, and that's why I think the principle is, and this, by the way, is the analogy of faith that the Reformers talked about, which is that you always interpret the implicit in light of the explicit and the cloudy in light of the clear.
Awesome. Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Hey, you got it, and God bless you and your one-year-old. Let's go back to the phone lines. We'll talk to Andy in Lincoln, Nebraska, listening to Bot Radio. Hi, Andy.
How's it going, Hank?
Good. How are you?
Good. I appreciate your ministry. So much nonsense going on out there, and you bring a lot of clarity to a lot of situations. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
I've been recently kind of in a debate with some Christian friends of mine. It kind of centers around the whole gay marriage issue. And they kind of take the position that because our country is, in their view, isn't a Christian country, that we shouldn't, as Christians, force laws that reflect our Christian values on other people because not everybody believes the same thing. I guess my position then would be Jesus said clearly, you're either for me or you're against me. So how can you say that you're for Jesus and then, whether it's at the voting booth or anywhere in any other avenue of life, you know, not represent him? And I mean, as far as gay marriage, clearly God said that marriage is between one man and one woman. So I guess I'm just curious on what your views would be and kind of how Christians are to interact with government.
Well, you know, one thing that's very interesting in light of the question is that the cover story of the current edition of the Christian Research Journal deals with that very question. The article is titled, Is Legislating Morality Biblical? There are people who say you can't legislate morality, but that's simply not true. It's not a matter of whether you're going to legislate morality. It's a matter of whose morality is going to be legislated. And so I think we need to be involved in every aspect of the political process. In fact, in every aspect of life, whether it's jurisprudence or art or science, we shouldn't abdicate those positions. We should be the change agents in the culture rather than being transformed by the culture. But ultimately, the way that culture has changed is when you change the heart, then the behavior of a person changes. So yeah, we should be involved, and we can't abdicate our responsibility. You know, if you have, I saw an actor on television being interviewed this morning while I was having my teeth worked on, and I was very interested, I won't mention his name, in saying that he didn't believe in any morality whatsoever. In fact, with respect to his kids, he wanted them to be able to do whatever they wanted to do, run wild. In fact, that was his phrase. And well, if you have that kind of a society where there are no rules, wow. You have chaos. You have the crumbling of society. And so there have to be rules. And those rules are either set by the size and scope of the latest lobby group, or they're set by an enduring North Star. And if you can demonstrate that the enduring North Star is, in fact, God and His Word, then obviously you want to capitulate to that because God knows what is best for those that He created.
Yeah, it's been so bizarre to be having this conversation with people that are Christians. I mean, if you're having this conversation with a secular humanist, that's one thing, but these are people that are Christians, so it's just been, I almost don't run out of things to say to them. I don't know how to get across to them, but...
Well, you know, this article, I think, is powerful. It is well-argued, well-articulated, and extraordinarily powerful. So either get the journal or get a copy of the article on the web, because I think it would be extraordinarily helpful to you.
All right, I appreciate that. One other thing, what specific passages do you look at in terms of how Christians are to interact with government?
Well, Romans chapter 13, I think, is a seminal package of insights in this regard. But obviously, the Bible as a whole gives us principles to follow, and those principles are that we as God's agents are not supposed to abdicate responsibility. In fact, we are to tend the garden, which means that we not only fulfill the Great Commission, but we fulfill the cultural mandate. We're, in fact, in training for eternity. The problem with a lot of Christian notions is that we're leaving anywhere, we're going to a place up there, so let everything go to hell in a handbasket. But that's not true. We're tending a garden and it matters. We're not only in training, but God doesn't scrap things, He redeems them. He's going to redeem this planet, and so we should be involved in every aspect of society. We should know about whether global warming is right, wrong, indifferent. We should have an opinion on that. Because if we miss that, then we're going to miss a lot of other things. If, in fact, global warming is throwing tens of trillions of dollars of the global economy at a fundamental problem that you can't really solve, and then you can solve providing fresh water to everyone who doesn't have it right now for $200 billion, then you get your eye on the wrong ball. So we should be informed in all issues. We shouldn't be speaking out of our hats, so to speak. We should be speaking out of informed knowledge, and therefore the world will sit up and take notice. For example, I remember how Christian leaders were on Y2K. They followed the cultural trend. The cultural trend. I was on Hannity and Combs, as it was called back then, and both Hannity and Combs were arguing with me on the side of a person suggesting that Y2K was going to be a global catastrophe. Well, the problem was that most Christians were saying exactly what the culture was saying when what the culture was saying was just rubbish. And so when I wrote that Y2K wouldn't even be a top 10 news story in the year 2000, everybody in the culture and everybody in Christianity came down my throat. Well, that doesn't matter. We don't need to be politically correct, but we should think things through so that we don't fall for sophistry and sloppy journalism and script torture and in the process vilify the name of Christ as opposed to exalting the name of Christ. So we sometimes have to go cross purposes to the culture. What I like about this article, by the way, getting back to it, is that there's a point counterpoint, and I think that helps someone see the various aspects of the argumentation as it takes place in a dynamic form.
Okay, thanks a lot. I appreciate that, Hank.
You got it. Thank you so much for your call. And do remember, this is one of the reasons that the Christian Research Journal is such an important instrument of the Christian Research Institute. And, you know, sometimes it is very difficult to spend the money to not only give credible information, but to present it in a very tasteful manner, so that the presentation augments the content. But we spend the money, we spend the resources doing it because we think it's important for us to do everything with excellence and to be on the cutting edge. So if you haven't subscribed to the Christian Research Journal, become one of those that support this very important magazine. Without the support, you know, things go away. You can subscribe in a safe, secure fashion on the World Wide Web at equip.org. You can write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. An easy way to subscribe as well is to pick up the telephone and talk to one of our resource consultants, that number 888-7000 and the letter CRI. Do you remember the Last Disciple series, the last installment, the last book in the trilogy is now out, available for your gift to the ministry. You can check that out online at equip.org as well. We'll be right back with more answers to your questions in just a moment.
The things we accumulate over our lifetimes, money, personal possessions, and property, are simply gifts from God, entrusted to us to manage as His servants. When we as Christians create a will or trust, what we're really doing is planning to transfer stewardship of what God has entrusted us to others. For many of us, this may be one of the most important acts of stewardship we will ever undertake. However, statistics show that 70% of us will die without a well-designed will or trust and needlessly transfer billions of dollars to the federal government that could have otherwise been used to benefit family and/or ministry. We have made special arrangements for you to explore this stewardship responsibility as well as other estate planning needs. Visit our website at equiplegacy.org/EPO. There you will find the estate plan organizer, a tool that will assist you by developing an estate plan that reflects your values and goals. To learn more, go to equiplegacy.org/EPO. The Bible Answer Man broadcast will return after this. The first century AD, a time of tribulation and terror as the Roman Empire descended on Jerusalem and the prophecies of Jesus and the book of Revelation came shockingly true before believers' very eyes. Now, this period of persecution, prophecy, and perseverance comes to life for you in a new work of fiction, The Last Temple, the long-anticipated completion of The Last Disciple trilogy by Hank Hanegraaff and Sigmund Brauer. You'll understand why Revelation's apocalyptic language was perfectly appropriate for these horrifying days and gain new courage to live out your faith in our own troubled times. The Last Temple is our thank you for your gift today. For your gift of $100 or more, we'll send you the whole Last Disciple trilogy. So please partner with us today by calling 888-7000-CRI or visiting equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching graphics with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what you'll find in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. In separate articles, Hank Hanegraaff and Steve Gregg make sense of Ezekiel's difficult temple vision. Other topics include, is legislating morality biblical? Did Jesus and Paul preach two different gospels? Are evangelicals really at war with science? An exploration of how Jack Kerouac shaped the life script of today's millennial generation. A summary critique of Mark and Grace Driscoll's controversial book, Real Marriage, The Truth About Sex, Friendship, and Life Together, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI or subscribe to the journal online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who testifies to everything he saw. That is, the Word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written in it, because the time is near.
Imagine a letter that could tell your future, written in code. Deciphering it could set you free. What's inside reveals the truth about the end of the world, but possessing it could kill you. The Last Disciple by Hank Hanegraaff and Sigmund Brauer. Available from CRI by calling 888-7000-CRI or by ordering directly from our website at www.equip.org.
See the events of the Book of Revelation through the eyes of one brave and determined man in Hank's new fiction work, The Last Temple. With its gripping storytelling, The Last Temple will help Revelation become real to you so you can apply its vital truths to your life. Let us send you a copy in appreciation for your gift of ministry support this month. For a gift of $100 or more, we'll send you the whole Last Disciple trilogy. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Here's more of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with your host, Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy. We'll go right back to our telephone callers. Next up is Steve listening in Kingsport, Tennessee on Sirius XM 131. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Hank. How's it going?
Doing good.
Good to listen to you. I'm glad you took my call. Earlier in the program, he was telling that other guy, he was talking about the temple being destroyed with fulfillment of God's word. Right? What was that? And said, like, they tore it down like 70 AD. But I don't see that it was fulfillment of his word, because Jesus said there won't be one stone upon another, and the western wall still stands.
Well, I mean, if you start reading the Bible in that fashion, you'll give all of the skeptics and infidels ammunition. As a Christian, you don't want to give them ammunition. You want to take ammunition away from them, because these are false bullets. The reality is that the Bible in this very text has Jesus Christ saying, then there'll be great tribulation unequaled from the beginning of the world until now and never to be equaled again. Now, if you read that in the same way you're reading this part of the passage with respect to the Western Wall of the Temple, then you end up having Jesus making a false prediction. But in reality, what Jesus is doing is using prophetic hyperbole. Obviously, Jesus Christ, who is God in human flesh, recognizes that the Old Testament says that the greatest tribulation that the Jews would ever suffer happened in the Old Testament with the exile, the Babylonian exile. That was the greatest tribulation. There'd never be a greater tribulation. So how can Jesus say there'll be a greater tribulation in the future? Well, again, that kind of reasoning is just false reasoning. Christ is using prophetic hyperbole. And I would say that in the case of the temple being destroyed, that prophecy came true in incredible detail. In fact, Jerusalem and the temple so destroyed that it was hard to see that a city had ever existed there. And I think that the Wailing Wall, so-called, is an exception to the rule that proves the prophecy. In other words, it stands there in moot testimony that the words of Christ were fulfilled. So you don't have to take a wooden, literalistic way of reading this. The point is, Jesus is saying that there is going to be devastating destruction such that Jerusalem will be decimated and the temple will be decimated, and all of that will take place within a generation.
Okay. Well, I'll just agree to disagree, but I don't think it's been fulfilled. I think it's still yet future. As long as that wall still stands, it's not been fulfilled.
Well, if you think it's future, remember you don't want to transgress what Hebrews tells you not to transgress, and that is to trample on the sacred blood of Jesus Christ, because he is the temple. He is the temple in our midst, and you, Steve, are a living stone in that temple, so recognize that the temple is here, and when the temple comes, you don't want to go back to a type and a shadow. You don't want to go back to temple, priest, and sacrifice when the ultimate sacrificial lamb has come. In fact, that's the very reason the temple was destroyed in the first place. It was because they didn't recognize Messiah in their midst.
Well, by no means would want to go back to that, but as I say, it ain't been fulfilled along with two stones, because he knows that wall is still going to be standing in 2012.
Well, as you said, Steve, let's agree to disagree agreeably, but I think the real issue in the conversation that should pique everybody's interest is, how can I learn to read the Bible for all it's worth? I want to go right back to the phone lines. We'll talk next to Jeff in Fayetteville, Arkansas, listening on Bot Radio. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Hank, first of all, let me just say God bless you and your ministry. It's a great help.
Well, thank you.
Could you explain what the Dead Sea Scrolls are, what effect they had on sort of like Bible historical field?
Well, a couple of things. One is you now have a Old Testament library available at the click of a 21st century mouse. That's pretty cool. But here's what happened in history. On August 30, you have an inconceivable event. August 30, AD 70, what I was talking about with our last caller. The destruction of the temple in complete fulfillment of what Jesus Christ had foretold. So the very day on which the former temple had been destroyed by the king of Babylon, the second temple was now set ablaze. And by September 26, all Jerusalem was in flames. 3 years later, the year was AD 73. It's an epic year in history. The Roman army advances on the Zealots who had taken over the Herodian fortress that's atop Masada. I've taken all my kids up there. Knowing that the Roman soldiers would soon be marching through their sacred compound on the northwest shore of the Dead Sea, what the Essenes did was they wrapped their beloved texts in linen, and they placed them in jars of clay, and they hid them in the caves 1 mile north of the Qumran community. I've actually been in those caves. It's kind of interesting. If you're standing by the Dead Sea, you look up, and you look like you're looking into mountains. But the top of those mountains are sea level, because the Dead Sea is the lowest spot on Earth. So they hid them in those caves. Well, after the Roman threat passed, they wanted to retrieve the scrolls and resume their treasured task of copying the sacred texts. But what happened was the Essene community did not survive. The good thing, however, is that the scrolls continued to live on in the cool, dry air of the caves, because that's where they hid them. And it wasn't until 1947 that there was the shattering of parchment-preserving pottery that pierced two millennia of silence. And, of course, that's when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. So that's why I say you have today an Old Testament library at the command of a 21st century mouse, because everybody can now access it. What's great about the discovery is it's the greatest manuscript discovery of modern times. And what's so cool about it is you have now proof positive that God has preserved his word over time. So before this discovery, the oldest extant text was the Masoretic text. It was 1,000 years removed, however, from the Dead Sea Scrolls. So now you have 1,000-year time frame by which you can test whether God has preserved his word over time. And the bottom line is, yes, he has. And I've laid all this out in my book, Has God Spoken?
Oh, that is really cool. Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
You got it, Jeff. Thank you so much for your call. Back to the phone lines. We'll talk next to Jim in Columbia, Missouri, listening on Bot Radio. Hi, Jim.
Thanks for taking my call, Hank.
Pleasure.
Thank you for your ministry also. What happens when adults that are taken before they're supposed to be taken and they haven't lived their life in total trust and faith for God?
Well, remember that what is essential in answering this question is that God does everything righteously in a holy fashion, tempered by his great love. So he's a God of justice, and he's a God of love. And therefore, we ultimately leave people in the hands of an infinitely just and infinitely merciful God, who we know in the greatest size takes every converging factor into consideration. Furthermore, the general principle is given by Paul as well when he says, from one man God created every nation of men, that they should inhabit the entire earth. He determined the exact times and places that they should live. And God did that so that men might reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. So God gives all of us the light of creation. He gives us an inner light as well, the light of conscience. Paul talks about that sequentially in Romans chapter 1 and Romans chapter 2. And if we respond to that, we also receive the light of Christ. Furthermore, there's a general principle that needs to be properly applied, but it is that it is not the absence of truth that damns, it is the despising of truth that damns. And Jesus made that point with Nicodemus when he said, light came into darkness, but men loved darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. So it isn't that people don't have enough light, it is that they want darkness rather than light. So they don't want the light that could be theirs. So in some sense, we have to take the people that you give in a hypothetical fashion and put them in the hands of an infinitely just and infinitely merciful God and say that even though we can't give every answer to every anecdote, we do know that we can trust God. And that was, of course, the lesson of the book of Job. You can't understand what's going on in the heavenlies, but you can trust God because he's given you enough information to know that he will not do something that is not in accord with his nature.
Well, I guess I'm saying is it's from experience of my own life. I've been in and out of being a Christian and falling in the addiction of drugs and everything else. And I was just wondering if at that time, if I wasn't following God like I am right now, you know, if somebody shot me or whatever, then would I go to heaven?
Well, again, it's a hypothetical, but here's why. I don't know you well enough. I'm just talking to you on the phone, so I don't know all the nuances, and I certainly don't have God's encyclopedic knowledge of your life. But here's what I do know, is there are a lot of people who have a said faith rather than a real faith. They say they believe, but they don't really believe. On the other hand, there are those who genuinely believe, but they're trapped in a snare, and it's hard to extract themselves from that snare. So they fall into sin. They may fall back into the snare of drug addiction, which is a powerful addiction. That does not mean that they've fallen overboard. It means that they have fallen, and therefore they are genuine believers. But I'm not in a position to judge that. I can see the outward appearance. God sees the heart. I know for certain that were I around when Judas was around, I would have said, man, I want to be like Judas. He was preaching the gospel. He was delivering people of demons. He was performing miracles along with his master. He was in Christ's inner circle. And we would have said, wow, I want to be like. But Jesus was not fooled. He recognized that Judas was there not because he loved the master, but he loved what was on the master's table. So we can easily be fooled, even by Christian celebrities, you know, where we say, wow, I want to be like that guy, and not realize, whoa, Jesus sees the heart of that person. That's a sobering thought for all of us.
So if you basically, you know, I know my heart and God knows my heart. So in other words, then I would go to heaven then.
Again, I don't know whether you had a said faith or a real faith at a particular stage in your life. All I know for certain is that if at this point you can genuinely say that you realize you're a sinner, you've repented of your sin, and you've received Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord, that he not only justified you, but beautifully he's also in the process of sanctifying you, daily conforming you to his image. It doesn't mean that you're not going to slip and fall in the future. It simply means that the one who has you in his hand isn't going to drop you out of his hand.
That answers my question. Thank you.
You got it, Jim, and with that, we're out of time for this edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Do remember, Monday through Friday at this time, your question answered on air when you dial 888-ASK-HANK. That translates to 888-275-4265. Our contact information as we close the broadcast on the World Wide Web, it's equip.org, via the mailbox 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. And you can always pick up the telephone, talk to one of our resource consultants at number 888-7000 and the letters CRI. And do remember to pray for this ministry. Support it financially if you can. We need you as part of the team. Thanks for joining in. We'll see you next time with more.
Thank you for joining us today. Our mission at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith, answer difficult Bible questions, and strengthen believers in their walk with the Lord. To find resources to help equip you, log on to equip.org. That's equip.org. Or call us at 888-7000-CRI. Feel free to write us also at CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by the Christian Research Institute, a ministry supported solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters. For decades, Mormon leadership has made a concerted effort to win over Americans by making it appear Mormons hold the same basic tenets as Christians. That's why Hank has taken the actual teachings of Mormons themselves and distilled them into an important resource to help you grasp the essential doctrinal differences between Mormonism and Christianity. The Memorable Keys to the Mormon Mirage Flipchart. Through the memorable acronym MORMON, you'll learn how Mormon leaders have redefined Christian terms so they can sound like they're agreeing with us, but mean something entirely different. But more importantly, you'll be equipped to use the deviations to share the truth and love with Mormons as God provides opportunities. Order Memorable Keys to the Mormon Mirage from the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. The first century AD, a time of tribulation and terror as the Roman Empire descended on Jerusalem and the prophecies of Jesus and the book of Revelation came shockingly true before believers' very eyes. Now, this period of persecution, prophecy, and perseverance comes to life for you in a new work of fiction, The Last Temple, the long-anticipated completion of The Last Disciple trilogy by Hank Hanegraaff and Sigmund Brouwer. you'll understand why Revelation's apocalyptic language was perfectly appropriate for these horrifying days and gain new courage to live out your faith in our own troubled times. The Last Temple is our thank you for your gift today. For your gift of $100 or more, we'll send you the whole Last Disciple trilogy. So please partner with us today by calling 888-7000-CRI or visiting equip.org.